Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Daily Friend podcast, your source of news and analysis. I'm Nicholas Lorimer, standing in for Big Daddy Liberty Sihle, who is unfortunately dealing with a emergency at home at the moment. With me in the studio are Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you today?
In fine form, yourself?
I'm very good, thank you. And Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you today?
I'm well, Nicholas, and yourself?
I'm very good, thank you, sir. All right, let's get into this. So we'll start off with Barry Bateman, who is in a bit of hot water with his employer for calling the leader of the EFF a very particular insult that begins with a P. Now, this had happened after...
Politician.
Not quite, a little bit shorter. This happened as Malema was appearing outside a court for charges relating to him firing a weapon in the air.
Meeting with the Hawks about the incident.
Yes. Mm. And the Barry Bateman, who is currently involved in a case with the Human Rights Commission against Malema, relating to journalism, asked him if he had, in a different case, whether he had attacked a policeman. And Malema, after giving several responses, said that he wished he had attacked the policeman. He didn't, but he wished he had, because whether you are white or pink, I will mess you up. Some words to that effect.
Yes.
As Malema was walking away, the cameras were still on, and Barry Bateman used the word to describe Malema being caught on camera. This went on Twitter, and as per usual, there was a sort of predictable Twitter outrage about this. EWN, Eyewitness News, which is Barry Bateman's employer, has since issued an unreserved apology to Julius Malema, which basically says we hold our journalists to very high standards, and he didn't meet them. Herman, what do you think?
I think it's bizarre. Firstly, I'm not a fan of the word. I don't use it personally. But what strikes me as bizarre is that someone like Barry Bateman, undoubtedly one of the top journalists in our country, that him saying a bad word, which isn't caught audibly on any recording, it's not part of any official reporting on any case, it just happened to be picked up visually by a camera, that there's more outrage about that than about Julius Malema just, you know, saying he wished he had violently assaulted a white or pink person more effectively. And we're more upset about this word than Julius Malema firing a weapon illegally at a political rally. Our priorities as a society, it seems to me bizarre that this word can trigger more vehement condemnation than anything Julius Malema has seemingly ever done. And I'm frankly quite disgusted that EWN would throw their reporter under the bus. So, as I say, Bateman is one of the top journalists in this country. Really, really worth his weight in gold for any news organization lucky enough to have him. And now to kind of have him raked across the coals for saying something that I think most South Africans would agree with, and not in any official capacity, that is somehow justifies him being, you know, embarrassed and removed from, you know, the media broadcasting and so on, I think is absolutely absurd.
Terence, you had some thoughts on the charge Malema was facing and this whole incident?
Well, yeah, look, I think just a preliminary observation is that it hasn't been a good couple of days for unscripted comment on the media, if one thinks about what happened with the president in his address last week. I think this is obviously embarrassing. I think that to some extent it demonstrates that the members of the Fourth Estate are human. And in a way, it's a sort of gift, I suppose, to Julius Malema that there's a certain bias shining through. Although I do remember that at one stage it was quite the thing, you know, to say, well, journalists, you know, do have their biases, and you know, we are not always neutral observers. We are struggling for an infinitely more just society or whatever. And you know, if that shines through in coverage of, oh, I don't know, Tony Leon or whatever, then you know, so be it. I think that this is a kind of Tempest in a Teapot. But yes, you know, that I think Herman is has hit the nail on the head. What you have here is a case where particular sentiments have been expressed, deeply, deeply problematic in a society with the level of violence we have, you know, especially, you know, given that over the last week or so, there's been so much focus on gender-based violence, and I think this kind of hyped-up machismo is, you know, plays very well into that. Just incidentally, on the firing of the alleged firing of the gun, I think that that's something that we shouldn't let slip. There's been a drive on the part of the government, which is long-standing, but you know, over recent years, to restrict the scope for civilian firearm ownership. Here you have somebody as the leader of a political party recklessly discharging it. Now, whether it was a toy gun or not, it shows a particular irresponsibility. You know, one does not simply discharge a weapon in a crowded space. Mm-hmm. I think that it also coincides with something else that I read yesterday, that apparently the police commissioner in the Northern Cape was robbed of his firearm, which he had apparently left in a car. Now, I'm not sure whether this is still the case today, but certainly application forms for licensing a firearm specify that you're responsible, and this was in writing, that you're responsible for the safekeeping of that firearm. If you lose it, you should be you will be prosecuted for criminal negligence. And it said explicitly, a car is not a safe place to leave a firearm. Well, you know, here you have the most senior policeman in the province being robbed of his firearm, and it was recovered. Apparently now it's not usable, which, you know, I think that one needs to understand that. There doesn't seem to be a sense that there'll be any consequences for him. You know, it says something when someone in that position in the state is reckless or not attentive to the responsibility of keeping a firearm.
Yeah, no, that's very concerning. One of the things that concerns me about this thing with Barry Bateman is that EWN immediately, they didn't just apologize, they took Barry Bateman off the air.
Yeah.
And they said that they will, quote, hold an internal probe that will deal with the matter appropriately. Now, I may be being painting with a little bit of a broad brush here, but I've often noticed that there's a lot more leeway given to journalists who report things factually incorrectly, or who make mistakes in their reporting and force the newspapers to apologize to be dragged before the news ombudsman and apologize. This does seem like quite a craven response, as far as I'm concerned. I understand that they have to maintain a professional standard, and that also they have to ensure that they're seen to be neutral and having their reporters insult someone sort of in that way is very undermining to that neutrality. But at the same time, there's been a sort of sharpness and an urgency to this reaction that is not present in a lot of other things.
And I think it's another case of one rule for your average South African, one rule for another, for your politician. I think if a journalist or Barry Bateman had said this of any other South African who wasn't an important politician.
Well, no, I don't even think it's that. Can you imagine this kind of response to Barry Bateman saying a similar thing about Musi Maimane? I suspect...
Yeah, that's probably true.
I suspect that it probably wouldn't be quite the same.
Because the EFF, they've got a very effective outrage machine on Twitter. They are very good at getting those kind of trends and hypes going. And I think, I agree with you, there's a professionalism aspect here that needs to be addressed. And I think, in a way, an apology from Bateman himself for quote-unquote unprofessional conduct.
Well, that's the other interesting thing about this is that Bateman himself, unless he said something on Twitter or something recently that I haven't seen. But when this initially happened, it was his company that apologized, not him.
Yes, and that's the odd thing for me, that if were I in charge or in a position of, you know, power at EWN, to me it would, the logical step would be to get the report of the journalist in question to issue an apology. And then, as the news organization say, we accept this apology, and that's that. But there's a kind of a terrifying instinct, as you say, to rush to this subservient position of, you know, just going above and beyond what should be just a plain apology. So as to, I don't know, not antagonize a specific political party.
Yeah, and this is a problem I have with quite a lot of reporting on the EFF specifically. Yeah. And this is outside of the opinion section, which has its own issues with how it covers the EFF. But I remember there was what I thought was an infamous piece on Times Live when one of the recent new MPs for the EFF gave her maiden speech. The headline was something along the lines of how the maiden speech of an EFF MP captured the hearts of South Africans. Now, that's quite a spin on it, I think, one that's not entirely justified. And the evidence presented for such a thing was basically a small collection of tweets, which does not a public survey make.
No.
And especially when it's very easy to find the opinions of the fighters themselves, you know, congratulating themselves. I mean, every time Usman Mamani gives a speech, it also, you know, captures the hearts of it doesn't
of a
mean,
bunch of DA people.
Exactly. It doesn't mean that the whole country has been swept up in the loving embrace of this political leader.
This whole story is a cocktail of many, many, you know, dangerous ingredients. One of them being how the media treats politicians, certain politicians, how the media can be objective and professional. But to get back to what Terence was saying, this is a normalization by having a larger outrage fallout on this than on, for example, Julius Malema allegedly firing an automatic weapon at a political rally. The fact that these outrages are so different in scale just reflects a normalization of the most bizarre and dangerous kind of political rhetoric in a powder keg that shows every indication of wanting to spark and blow up.
No, it definitely shows that our sort of media political elites have got a very strange idea of what's important and what's not. Mm. All right, well, let's move on. So Ace Makashula, as our favorite ANC politician, has been saying some things that got people a bit upset. Terence, why don't you tell us a little bit about what he said?
Well, apparently he was speaking at a meeting, I think, to a group of students, and he made some comments which attracted a great deal of attention, supposedly saying, well, you know, white people are foreigners. Now, what we were able to trace to track down makes me question whether that interpretation is correct. What he did seem to be saying was that there are white foreigners in the country who are never regarded as foreigners. Now, I think, once again, that's also a contentious position. I think perhaps the issue is that there is very, very little white immigration now, but I certainly remember growing up in a mining town, the term immigrant was often, you know, used in a slightly hissing tone to... and these people were, you know,
Polish
or Welsh or whatever. What I did find particularly interesting is that he said we must never despise people who have the same skin color as us. You know, it seems to be defaulting to the most...
Well, that's racial nationalism in a nutshell,
isn't it? Well, absolutely, yeah. You know, it seemed to be, we shouldn't do this because these people look like us, not because, you know...
It's wrong.
Not because, you know, smashing and looting a business is just, no, you don't do that.
Just pick your business as a target that doesn't resemble your kind of people.
Exactly, yeah. There's an implication there that doing that to people who are not of your race is fine.
Well, yeah,
or at least not as bad.
Yes. You know, it's this bizarre sort of hierarchy of pathologies that we don't really like that. But if you're going to do it, we'll rather do it that way. And I think it's it's very very much like what some of you I believe wear red berets have been saying about, well, we should direct our anger at white monopoly capital. Now, wonder whether that doesn't trip into the first word as opposed to the next two in that phrase. Once again, it's indulging in a crude, crass, unproductive, unconstructive form of a form of groin politics.
And to come back to the normalization of dangerous trends, that this can be said is just again showing, and that this can be said with not much of a public outcry. Mm. That this can be said is dangerous in painting certain people as legitimate targets of illegal acts, and those people being specifically race bound.
Yeah, it does seem as though the sort of racial nationalist pan-African ideology that is infused in our elite circles. That's an idea that outside of South Africa has been, I think, functionally dead, if not dead in the rhetoric for a very long time. Mm. But in South Africa, it seems that it's also dying here as well, because on the ground, the facts are just the fact that there is this sort of xenophobic violence that other Africans are seen as such an enemy that they need to be driven out, that they're invaders, that kind of thing. It shows that this pan-Africanist ideology has just failed to kind of really gain real purchase in South Africa.
And opinion polls support that idea that many, many South Africans, I think a majority across the board of racial demographic groups, say there are too many foreigners in South Africa.
So it seems as though our political elites are desperately trying to clutch on to those kind of racial narratives and keep them alive, because they are being undermined by this violence, which is not a very good reason.
No, I mean it's not even clutching at straws. It's like clutching at a straw while it is choking a tortoise.
That's a very interesting metaphor.
Thank you. Yes, yes. A few metaphors just collided there cosmically.
I take it you don't use plastic straws.
No comment.
Just yes. Get on board, Herman. Get on board.
I'm sorry, Terrence. I'm not as woke as you are.
All right. So plastic straws aside, let's move on to something perhaps a bit more important for our financial security. So the rating agency Moody's was recently asked by some journalists what the prospect of a downgrade was. And they said that it was a very low likelihood that there would be a downgrade, despite sort of expectations before the time, and that they believed that South Africa's debt levels would soon stabilize and that there was no need really to panic. Mm. Herman, what do you make of this approach, this claim?
Well, it is quite odd. In the same breath as saying that they are not downgrading our outlook from stable to negative and our changing our credit rating from Baa3 to sub-investment grade, at the same time as doing that, not doing that, they downgrade their growth forecast for South Africa in 2019. About a year ago, they had our growth forecast for this year at 1.3%. Then in June, they downgraded it to 1%. Now they downgraded it further to 0.7%. So on the one hand, they are saying, yeah, it's not going bad enough for us to, in November, follow Standards and Poor's and Fitch in making South Africa sub-investment grade. But at the same time, they are saying that our economy is unlikely to hit 1% GDP growth this year. But I mean, the Lucy Villa of the lead analyst for Moody's in South Africa, she said that they based the outlook, keeping it at stable, not going negative on it. They based that on not just 1 year of GDP growth. They anticipate an uptick of GDP growth in 2020. But I think you and I yesterday had a bit of a, pulling out our hair session, because the idea that our debt is somehow stabilizing or shows some signs of stabilizing is just absolute lunacy. This, our debt currently is I think at 55, 58% or something like that. It's quite near 60, or it's in the towards the dangerous half of 15, and that's without things like the NHI. That's without things like the ESCOM bailout. So how they can see our debt stabilizing, I genuinely have no idea.
Right, so we'll get back to the spending question in a second. But Terence, what do you think of this prospect of us, our economy growing at next year at sort of over 1%?
Well, I think
it's very difficult to predict these things, but
yeah. Well, look, I think with the last year or so that we've had, 1% might seem like a gift from heaven, which is sad because it's nowhere near what we need. The National Development Plan was talking about 5.4%. We need to kick this into several times our population growth, and at 1%, we are still skating under that. I can only say that I think growth and growth, of the type that actually leads to real fixed investments, or that is driven by real fixed investments and that creates jobs as a happy byproduct, should be a policy obsession. But I think that unfortunately that falls way below the ruling party's radar. I think its first priority is to maintain some semblance of unity amongst itself, and I think the ANC and government is more interested in expanding the footprint of government and government programs. And wittingly or not, and I hope it's unwittingly, because if it's wittingly, the problems are even more serious than we can imagine. It's shown a de facto willingness to see growth being thrown under the bus, or to make no real attempt to get it going.
Yeah, I think that's exactly why I'm so shocked by these comments from Moody's, because we haven't seen the reform that has been expected, the pro-growth reforms from Ramaphosa's cabinet. And also, the spending problems don't seem to have been addressed at all. So although Moody's mentions ESCOM, they just say, in the long term, they need to fix ESCOM. Well, so far, there's been very little evidence that anything's going to be done to fix ESCOM. So Parliament keeps kind of under the radar, passing these new bailout bills to make sure that the interest can be paid off on ESCOM's debt. But ESCOM hasn't actually turned itself around. Also, despite repeated promises over the years to cut the public sector wage bill, there's been absolutely no movement on that front whatsoever.
Yeah.
Despite the claims of many finance ministers.
And I think that's basically off the table now.
Yeah.
It's politically impractical. And what struck me about what the analyst, what Via said, is that we have a reform-minded or a reform-orientated government. And I'm not quite sure what she bases that on.
Well, yes, because they want to spend more money.
Yes, what in terms of she explicitly said that a long term plan to stabilize the financial situation of ESCOM is absolutely vital and would play a huge role. But the idea that this will somehow be forthcoming is worrying. The closest we've come to some sort of economic policy reform was Tito Mboweni's policy paper about 2 weeks ago, and we've heard nothing about it from our president, basically, other than, yes, we will discuss this. This will be discussed. So the idea that we have a reform-minded government, I'm not sure what they base this on.
Also, it's very curious because the government is intending to spend more money on things like NHI, as we've mentioned. Now, if the government of Portugal, for example, said that it was going to massively increase its health spending by orders of magnitude above what it is now, we wouldn't ignore that and just say, oh, well, I guess there's... this is going to have no effect on GDP. It seems as though Moody's is not taking the government at its word, as though it just assumes that sort of policies like NHI are not going to actually be implemented.
No, I think that's quite correct. I think that there is still an aura around President Ramaphosa as being the urbane businessman, the reformer who needs some sort of space and some sort of cover, and then all will be revealed. Since the beginning of last year, people have been talking about the long game. Well, we are 20 months into this game.
How long do they want this game to be?
Yes.
The other concerning thing for me is that there's been a lot of murmurings in the sort of international finance and economic analysis communities that the world is headed for some sort of slowdown. We've seen slowdowns in China. Mm. There's been a slight slowdown in India, which are, of course, two huge economies. The US hasn't been growing. It's not sure if it's slowing down or if it's kind of staying where it is currently. Mm-hmm. The growth is not what it was.
Right. No.
And so in an environment where, and of course, there's also fears of recession. There was some discussion in the US a while ago about what they call the inverted yield curve being a warning, an early warning sign of a recession. With that in mind, it seems that us suddenly, doubling our growth next year in a global climate where things seem to be slowing down, it doesn't seem particularly likely, especially considering that reforms
aren't forthcoming. Yeah. You're absolutely right. If we look at the IMF forecasts for China, India, the Eurozone, and the United States, they all flatline in economically for the next, from 2020 until 2024 about. So, and that's kind of a positive spin on it, because there are significant risks with global government debt reaching quite dangerous levels. So we're sitting in a very fragile position in terms of the global economy. And if something were to cause a downturn, South Africa would be very, very badly placed to weather the storm. The last time in 2008, when we hit the storm, we were growing at 3% annually. We had...
it was more than that.
It was at 2008. Yeah, I think it was 3 or 4%. A few years before that, we had three consecutive years of over 5% growth. But we were heading into the storm with something close to a budget surplus, falling
very
unemployment,
healthy financials.
And very healthy financials. And if a repeat or a sequel to such a global storm were to hit, we would be going into it with, a sip that comes pre-sunk.
Yes, no, that's, I think, a good way of putting it. So a very puzzling call from Moody's there. But anyway, I think that's all that we have time for today. So if you like what you heard here and want to support the Institute, you can SMS your name to 32823. The SMS costs R1 and terms and conditions apply. Thank you for listening to The Daily Friend, and we'll catch you on the Friday edition.